aggressive driving is not one of the ways individuals can take steps to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. That's according to Jonathan Gilligan, one of the co-authors of a new article about small steps each of us can take to reduce carbon emissions while saving money on energy bills. Jonathan, what did you hope to accomplish with this article titled Household Actions Can Provide a Behavioral Wedge to Rapidly Reduce U.S. Carbon Emissions?
A lot of people have looked before at lists of lots of actions people can take to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. But previous to this, people hadn't looked at the question of, so this is what people could do if they would change their behavior. What kind of things actually make people change their behavior? And how many people might you realistically expect would change their behavior, take these actions, and reduce their environmental footprint? So what we did here was to combine the work from the engineering literature on greenhouse gas emissions with work from the behavioral sciences literature on human behavior to try to talk about realistically, if we don't assume everybody changes their behavior, but we look at how many people we might realistically expect would adopt these actions in the next 10 years, what kind of policy results could we hope for? And the results suggest that if we use well-defined, well-designed policies to encourage people to change their behavior, we could be very successful at reducing greenhouse gas emissions for very little cost.
What do you mean by the term behavioral wedge?
This is relating to a term that was introduced in the economics and climate change literature by a couple of economists at Princeton who talked about what they referred to as wedges for greenhouse gas emissions reduction. Their idea was that if we look at the total amount of reduction we have to have in greenhouse gases over the next 50 years, it seems like an insurmountable problem. But if you break that huge amount up into a number of small wedges, each of which involves some technology or some change that can be made right away, and you think about it as a wedge, so it's like a triangle with the narrow end is today, and it grows steadily over time over the next 50 years to grow into a very large amount of reduction. So what we're saying is that individual behavior change could function as one of these wedges. And then if you take enough wedges together, one might be these behavior changes, another might be increasing the use of solar or wind power, another might be increasing the use of nuclear power, things like that. You add all the different wedges up that are possible, then it becomes an actually possible feat to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by the amount that we have to over the next 50 years.
This research focuses just on what the individual can do in
That's correct.
The house, right?
That's exactly right. We're focusing just on the emissions from people in their daily lives, turning electricity on and off in the house, heating and cooling, and driving your personal car. Because some work that Professor Vandenberg did a couple of years ago, and which has been replicated by others, shows that the emissions from individuals in these daily actions amounts to somewhere between 32% and 42% of the total U.S. emissions. And that means it's bigger than any other single sector. It's bigger than the manufacturing and industry sector. It's bigger than the commercial sector. So the single biggest sector of carbon emissions in the United States is those individual behaviors. And we're saying you need to target those, but you need to target them differently from the way you would target big industrial emitters. So we're looking with this research at how, instead of putting a lot of intrusive regulations in place, the government could adopt best practices programs to encourage voluntary behavior change. And we think that's a realistic way to get big emissions reductions.
Give us some examples of the ways that we can, in our everyday lives, cut back on the greenhouse emissions.
Several of these are very straightforward. Some of the very big places that people can save is if your house is not adequately insulated, insulate it properly. If it's very drafty, seal up the drafts to prevent cold air from coming in the winter, hot air in the summer. Those things will save you money at the same time they're reducing the environmental impact. Other things people can do, if you are idling in your car, you're stopped at a drive-through lane or something, turning off the engine after 10 seconds actually saves money because it reduces wear and tear on the car, it reduces pollution, and it saves money on gasoline consumption. So again, a lot of these things are win-win.
You mentioned, I think, in the paper, turning down the temperature on your water heater, correct?
Yes.
But in the winter, when people are really cold, is that something you think people would be willing to sacrifice?
There's a real misunderstanding that's possible there, because we're not talking about turning down the water heater to an uncomfortable temperature. A lot of water heaters in the United States are set to temperatures that are so high that they're really scalding and could burn somebody. So we're only talking about turning down the temperatures to 120 degrees, which is the recommended set point for safety in the home. A lot of water heaters are turned up hotter. That presents a safety hazard for children, and it also wastes electricity.
And how did you come up with all these data findings?
It was a lot of work. We basically started with a list of about 45 possible behaviors and looked through everywhere that we could find to find what studies had been done on the emissions associated with them. Then we narrowed it down to a list of 33 that seemed to have reasonable impact and where we felt very confident that the data was reliable. And then we sorted those in priority of what was producing the biggest emissions reductions.
I saw there was an article, I believe, out of India, and that's a country, I guess, that traditionally people have hung their clothes mm-hmm. out to dry outside. And it was pointing out that your research suggests that we do that too when mm-hmm. possible, right?
That's right. That's not one of the biggest things. So for people who cannot hang their clothes out to dry, there are many other things they can do that will have a bigger impact. But where you can do that, either hang them outside to dry or just indoors on a drying rack can be a very effective thing. You reduce your energy consumption, you reduce your energy bills. So a lot of the savings come not from any one thing, but from lots of little things added together.
And does your study look at all at variations among different parts of the country?
No. That's something I think really needs to be researched in the future, and I'm particularly interested in seeing future research look at questions of driving behavior in different parts of the country. But there's little enough data that we really have not been able to do comparative studies of how one part of the country compares to another.
So you think that people would drive differently in different areas that would affect the gas emissions?
Absolutely. I've discussed with researchers who work on behavior and driving in California, and there's not a lot of comparable research in the Southeast, but intuitively, I really feel that drivers in the Southeast will have many different attitudes about driving and also many different constraints on the way that they drive. That means that what works in California may not apply here, and there may be other things that apply here that may be very different from what works in California. So we want more research on regional variations, but right now we just don't have the information to be able to tell.
And when we're talking about, you know, reducing the carbon imprint, idling, I know, is one thing. Are there some other things with driving you look at, too?
Other things that we look at with driving, one of the big ones is a less aggressive pattern of driving with less use of rapid acceleration and braking can make a very big difference. We look at carpooling, but we're very pessimistic that we could convince very many people to start carpooling. So even though there's a lot of potential there, it's a relatively small part of our total budget of what we think is possible, because we're trying to look at what people would really do.
And did you look at any data about how much you would save on your bills if you do these things?
We haven't added it all up together. A lot of these individual actions will save quite a bit of money, but we didn't total up what everything will do. Potentially, based on a previous paper that we published last summer, it looks like a subset of these actions, if about a third to a half of all Americans adopted them, would save tens of billions of dollars per year nationwide on electricity costs. Some of the specifics that I can immediately think of is if you cut off the idling when you're not driving for more than about 10 seconds, that can save as much as a couple of $100 a year right there.
And are you figuring only about a third to half of people would be willing to make these changes?
That was an estimate that said if that many made them, that's how much we would save from a smaller set of these behaviors. That was just from seven behaviors. With these behaviors, the amount we think would make the change varies a lot. We think only about 15% of the people might start to carpool, but we think, and we have solid reasons from previous studies to believe this, that 90% or so would be likely to weatherize their houses, to insulate and so forth. And similarly, around 80% of people might, when the time comes to replace their furnace or their air conditioner, buy a more energy efficient model.
Is idling the number one thing people should reduce?
No, there are a lot of other things. Idling is one of them that isn't immediately obvious to people, but it's not one of the biggest. The biggest things people should do to reduce, the very biggest in the list that we put together, was the next time that you're buying a car, buy a more fuel-efficient model. And that doesn't mean that if you're buying a big car, you have to switch to buying a hybrid or a subcompact. But if you're buying a medium-sized car, buy a more fuel-efficient medium-sized car. If you're buying an SUV, buy a more fuel-efficient SUV. So within the same model range, simply buying one of the more fuel-efficient cars of that type is probably the biggest saving. Other than that, replacing heating and air conditioning equipment with more energy-efficient models when it's time to do it. You don't have to rush out and do it right away. Adequately maintaining your heating and cooling equipment in the house. Get the air conditioner tuned up every year. And properly insulate and weather strip the house. Those are the things that are a lot of the biggest.
Does it tend to be that the newer houses are built more energy efficient?
Often, but not always, because very often the newer houses are built, they're just so large that even if they're more energy efficient per square foot, there's so many square feet, and people like to put all sorts of things, lots of windows, lots of things in them. So they're not always, but sometimes they are.
So where could people read about this research?
We have a website for this that is behavioralwedge.msu.edu, where the paper is available for free download, also supplementary materials and presentations that we have made on the paper. Also, the Vanderbilt Climate Change Research Network webpage at the law school is another good place to read more about what we're doing.
Who are your colleagues on this particular paper?
My colleagues are Professor Michael Vandenberg from the Vanderbilt Law School, Thomas Dietz from Michigan State University, Paul Stern from the National Research Council, and Gerald Gardner from Michigan also.
Will this research then be extended, or will you go off in a slightly different direction?
We're going to both pursue some new directions and also extend this research. Some of the next things we're working on are publishing some more detailed mathematical methods for estimating these kinds of savings that are possible, and also doing policy-related studies talking about what specific public policies would be most likely to be effective in producing these kinds of changes that we've described here.
Jonathan Gilligan is an associate professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences and associate director of Vanderbilt's Climate Change Research Network. For Interview, I'm Avery Deer Owens.